Brian Noonan, he's playing on the radio, baby.
News, traffic, sports, weather. News, traffic, sports, weather. News, traffic, sports, weather. News, traffic, sports, weather. The bell tolls. It's
Noonan o'clock.
I hear voices in my head, they talk to me.
You're stealing my pot pie.
Bernard, did you rip up the store today?
Yeah, he's got the front tires.
No, Mama, I was a good employee today.
Why, son, I said, son, let me get myself a daiquiri over here. Run down, pick me up a moon pie and an RC Cola. I'm going to meet you down by Kirkwood through the wash.
You could say I'm a little bit crazy.
That is the most sinister call laugh that we've ever had on this program, Cody. You need to isolate that laugh.
Noonan o'clock.
Hey, let's just joke around and entertain 18 to 34-year-olds, shall we?
Well, it's the big show. Yes, it's a big, bad show tonight. Oh. Yeah, it's the big show. Come on, crank it up and turn on all the lights, y'all. Oh. Well, get ready for something that you'll never know.
Well, good evening. Welcome. Glad you're with me. Brian Noonan on 720 WGN. A snowy Sunday night firmly ensconced in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue, where people are braving the elements on this Valentine's Day. Perhaps they are out in search of a last-minute gift from Walgreens. You can run over there, get your beloved a carton of smokes, some energy drinks, whatever it is, to make sure that you do not forget. If you want to get a hold of the show, and we hope you do, it's always more fun when you're involved, 312-981-7200 is the number. When you call in, you'll be talking to the very hardworking and talented Elif Garris. She is executive producing the big show tonight. If you're nice to her, you get to me. That's how it works. You can also keep in touch with us via social media, Brian Noonan Show on Facebook and Twitter. Did I mention that number, 312-981-7200? That's a text number as well. So, of course, we will be talking a little Valentine's Day to get things started, but then we are going to delve into the loss of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia with Professor Jeffrey Stone, one of former Justice Scalia's colleagues at the University of Chicago. We'll also talk about the new cover girl of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, breaking some molds, changing the paradigm, if you will, of swimsuit models on Sports Illustrated. Some people love it, some people, as evidenced by Mark Carmen's reaction and others, a little bit upset by that. Karen Conti will be here after 8 o'clock to answer all of your legal questions. We have a little doubleheader tonight. We have a little naked news and a little Florida news. So we've got everything to get going. Roger, I have to ask, is there a road in Illinois that you did not report on your last newscast? Because I think you did road conditions for about 7.5 minutes. I think, could we be safe to assume
it's a mess
that
out there?
Every road is... Yeah. Really bad. Travel times are going to be escalated. If you've lived in Chicago for more than 17 minutes, you probably realize that once it starts snowing,
yes,
traffic is snarled everywhere.
The only difference, I think,
is that you're talking now, so you want to
that on a Sunday night in Chicago at this hour, usually there's not much traffic out there to speak of.
Right, but that's because things are moving quickly. So there's no traffic. But again, I go back to my original point and posit that once there is any sort of inclement weather, snow being the major culprit, that we know that I'm looking out at Michigan Avenue. It's much heavier than normal because it's snowing.
Plus, it's Valentine's Day, too.
Sure, people are out. Yeah. So that's, but feel free. If there's a rural route that you need to include in your next report, that would be fine. Some sort of two-lane cow path in rural southern Illinois.
Two lanes, no, just one lane.
Yeah, some dirt trail through a farm or a field that you need to report on. We won't just assume that the roads are bad. We will just we'll kick back. Let me know though, because I'm going to go out and I'm going to take a nap and then I'll come back in.
Here's the ironic thing though: the only road that seems to be clear of any major significance. Lakeshore Drive.
Yes, that's because everybody is smart enough to realize that once it starts snowing, there's not a chance they're getting on Lakeshore Drive.
Except
they've seen.
Except for me.
Sure. And you, Now you're going to bask in your past glories or infamy as you want. But yes, this is, and let's, before people start panicking, now that you've brought that up, this snow is not going to be.
No.
Like, this snow is going to end soon. Yeah. And then in the middle of the week, we'll get a little bit more. And this is nothing. This is
it'll just, be 50 by the weekend.
Right. This is nothing. It's February in Chicago. We've been spoiled this winter, and now everybody is panicking. I feel, though, that I have to say this every time it snows or rains, because I don't know where the drivers come from that have not been out. But inclement weather does not erase the paint on the roads. The line markers are still there.
Exactly.
Even if you think maybe they're a little, you're obscured a little, you can't really see, that's fine. And also, I firmly believe there's a special section of hell reserved for people who text while they drive.
There's a
sub-basement of that special level of hell for people who text and drive with the roads the way they are. Yeah. I almost got killed on Harlem Avenue because some imbecile was looking down and came into my lane while he was texting. And, of course, you can't stop as quickly on these roads because, let's repeat, it's snowing out. And as Roger reported ad nauseum, every road is bad. So do not do that. All right. That's enough of that. We're going to take a quick break because, we got to take a break. Elif's mad at me already because I'm late. Get used to it, Elif. I'm never on time for anything. I know I've beaten Cody into submission with that, and you'll learn. So you've worked with me enough to know that, time is nothing to me. I do not fear the clock. I don't respect the clock. The clock and I have an adversarial relationship, and so I'll break whenever.
Sounds good.
But listen, you're doing your job, so I don't fault you for that. All right, let's do this. And we'll talk a little bit about Valentine's Day. Feel free if you need to vent a little bit. Maybe your Valentine's Day didn't go quite as it should. And also, can we? I like Amy Poehler and Leslie Knope as much as the next guy who was a huge fan of Parks and Recreation. But Galentine's Day, really? Can't you just be not in a relationship? Do we have to make a huge ordeal, ladies? I know you're all empowered. 312-981-7200. We'll talk a little Valentine's Day on the other side. It's WGN. Happy Valentine's Day. I know it's winding down, but some of you may have been a little lax in your Valentine's Day preparation and just be taking care of things now. And if that's the case, why not? You still got time. You still got 6 hours, technically, for Valentine's Day to be in effect. Valentine's Day is always a quandary for me. It's a puzzle. I have to observe it because if not, I think I would be in trouble. Even though my wife told me, don't get me anything for Valentine's Day. Which I know, and every man in a relationship knows, is a trap. It's a devious trap set by women to lure you into complacency so that they have ammunition later in life to come back at you with some sort of evil comments. Because, hey, I love you, ladies, but you do remember everything. Now, if I got nothing for Valentine's Day this year, which I wanted because I don't believe that Valentine's Day is for men, I don't think guys need to get presents, even though I am sporting the gift that my wife gave me, very grateful, and yet, turns out it was a Christmas gift that was ordered and didn't arrive in time, so she kept it for Valentine's Day. That's fine. That's perfect. I didn't miss it at Christmas. I thought it was lovely now, but the point is, guys don't need it. Ladies, even though you say you don't, some of you say you don't care about Valentine's Day. There was a stat I read the other day that 53% of women said they would end a relationship if they didn't get anything for Valentine's Day. So, you do think it's important, ladies, so much so that you cannot just ignore it if you are not in a relationship. You have had to follow the lead of a fictional character and celebrate Galentine's Day, which to me just sounds like ladies going out on a random February night. But doesn't it? It seems weird to me that a holiday that most people will say they want to eschew, pay no attention to, they bemoan it as a Hallmark holiday, but some ladies have to, we've got to do something special to commemorate the fact that we're single and, doing things. And I don't want to say alone because that's not the right terminology, but not in a relationship. That's probably a politically correct way to say it. Not in a relationship, right? Because it doesn't mean you're alone just because you don't have a partner. Just means you have friends, you have family, whatever. But I think to have to get together and do it. Now, Elif, your Galentine's Day was spent here working with Dean and with me, so that's got to be the highlight of any young woman's Valentine's Day, to get to spend the day here working with us.
You have that. You've hit the nail on the hammer.
On the head.
Hammer on the head. Nail
hit
on the head.
Hit the nail on the head.
Yes.
With the hammer.
Yes.
You need to watch Weekend Workbench on WJED TV. They'll tell you all about that. And Lou Manfredini at 10:30. He'll tell you about hitting nails on the head and hitting things with a hammer. So do you, as a young woman, and I don't know if you're in a relationship or not, I'm not prying for that, but do you buy into this Galentine's Day kind of thing?
Really, I do, because I'm not a huge fan of Parks and Rec, but I've definitely celebrated Valentine's Day with girlfriends before. It's just an excuse to go out and celebrate the love you have for your friends.
Sure, but don't. I mean, men do that. Don't people do that all the time? Anytime you have a girls' night out or you're out with your friends, isn't that kind of the same thing? Does it? I just find it weird the timing that you have to do it on Valentine's. That some women feel that they have to do it on Valentine's Day, which goes against everything, because I don't think for men or women, if you're in a relationship on Valentine's Day, that doesn't define who you are.
No.
You know, like I know my daughter does not have a Valentine, quote unquote. She's not doing anything special tonight. She's studying. She's going out. You know, she's got sorority meeting, whatever she's got going on at school. It's not a big deal. But I saw a number of Facebook posts from women that I know, but, oh, it's Galentine's Day. And I was like, okay. Isn't it just Sunday with your friends? It just seemed weird to have to put the label on it.
You know how Christmas is Christmas? Well, this is like Love Day, you know?
So sure, well,
it's a hallmark. It is a hallmark holiday.
No, it's based in fact. It's based in history. It's got a lot of historical significance. I don't know if it is Love Day. I mean, I guess that's what it's supposed to be. I don't count to it. Roger, did you succumb to the Valentine's Day pressure?
I learned my lesson last year.
And what?
Well,
did you ignore it last year?
You
sound very down now, don't you? You were very energized during your 19-minute traffic report.
Right.
Don't well, sound down now when I actually ask you a question.
All right. So last year, the word was that, you know, we don't need to do anything special. Because, you know, I've got my threefer this week. Remember in February, it starts on the 14th with Valentine's Day. The 18th is my wife's birthday, and the 21st is our anniversary. So in 7 days, I've got the Holy Trinity.
Okay.
So I thought that, you know, I'd save up for, like, the anniversary.
Sure, that sounds
last
good.
Last year. You know, and kind of pack it all together.
I think that's fine.
Yeah, no. No. So we exchanged cards this morning.
Cards are the biggest scam in the history of merchandising.
And if you get there early, you get the cool ones.
Yeah, but still, the cool ones are... Really? $5 for a folded piece of paper?
That's
or
right.
More? No, it's not.
It'll be in a drawer for the next 20 years.
No, do you save them? My wife bought me a card today.
Yeah.
I read it. I went, oh, thanks. And I'm sure by the time I get home, well, she won't throw it in the garbage. It'll be in the garbage by garbage day.
No, see, you can't do that.
Why?
Not so soon. Give it at least a month.
Absolutely not.
Oh, my God.
Why? Why would I keep a card? I haven't kept any
card. Sentimental.
It's not. It's not sentimental, because the feelings that she expressed in the card, she expresses to me on a regular basis, which is great. So I don't need a piece of folded construction paper to tell me that. I don't need, you know, she signed it from both her and my daughter, because my daughter is away.
Right.
My daughter tells me the same thing. I'd rather hear it from them. I don't need a card to go, I wonder if they care about me at all. Let me see a month later if it still does. Oh, there's the
Elif,
dog with the smiley face.
This.
It's ridiculous.
Elif, back me up on
Elif,
this.
How long do you keep a greeting card, Elif?
I don't keep it for that long.
There you go.
Oh, man.
Sorry,
good.
Roger.
Wow.
I live in an alternate universe.
Man, somebody from the 206 very angry, thinking I'm making fun of women, thinking I'm ripping on women.
No, you're not.
I don't think so either. People need to lighten up.
No,
I love women. It surprises me that women who I believe are very strong and independent and successful still kind of, there's that little bit of them that wants the fairy tale of Valentine's Day, and so they don't have it, and they glom onto something that was created on a sitcom, which is, I mean, going out with your friends and celebrating your friends is a wonderful thing. I just think that it seems a little, I don't know, seems a little weird to have to do it on Valentine's Day. Because do you really, if you're not in a relationship, do you really miss Valentine's? I mean, does Valentine's Day really affect you? It probably affects people differently. I know when I was not in a relationship, I didn't care one way or another. I looked at all the advertising, I looked at all the stuff, and I went, okay, well, whatever. It's not my thing. And I think most people are like that, aren't they? But to get, to get all worked up, oh, my goodness. He's making fun of women. No, I'm not making fun of women. You'd know if I was making fun of women. This is not making fun of anybody. We're going to talk to Professor Jeffrey Stone from the University of Chicago on the other side of the news. He was a colleague of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. We'll talk about his legacy and what's coming up next for the country, for the Supreme Court. A lot happening in the last 24 hours, and the next year is going to be very, very interesting. So we'll get into all of that on the other side. This is 720 WGN. Brian Noonan on 720 WGN. News came yesterday that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was dead. He died of apparent heart attack. That was the news that came out this afternoon. That throws not only the Supreme Court into flux, but it changes the face of this election. It changes the face of the last year of President Obama's term. It changes a lot of things. Trying to get to know, most of us have opinions about Justice Scalia, whether it's favorable, unfavorable. Obviously, he had very strong opinions. He did not hide those opinions, which his job is not to. Professor Jeffrey Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago, and he was a colleague of Justice Scalia. He joins us now on WGN. Professor Stone, thanks for taking some time tonight. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So give us a little background on how you came to know Antonin Scalia, how you were acquainted at work, things like that.
Well, in 1977, after he had finished a stint working in the executive branch in the Nixon and Ford administrations, Scalia decided that after Carter was elected, he didn't have much of a future in the federal government at the moment. And so he was interested in going back into legal education. He had taught briefly at the University of Virginia before going to work for the Nixon administration. And so he applied for a position at the University of Chicago, and we hired him in 1977. I was then a relatively young faculty member, and he was about 10 years older than I. And we got to know each other quite well. He taught constitutional law, as did I. And we became not just colleagues, but friends. He was a lively, engaging, challenging colleague, and we disagreed about pretty much everything. I was sort of an ACLU Warren Court type, and obviously that's not what Antonin Scalia was.
Obviously.
So we would disagree frequently about various constitutional issues, but always in a civil and productive manner. I don't think I ever persuaded him very much, and I know he didn't persuade me very much, but we learned from each other and came to understand each other's views. And then after he left with the election of Ronald Reagan, he was appointed to the Federal Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, and then several years later, the Supreme Court. But we kept in touch over the years and maintained our relationship. So that's how I know him.
So if you could put his tenure on the Supreme Court into perspective, where do you think he will be remembered as one of the justices?
Well, he was very influential in a couple of important respects. First, he came to the court with a passionate commitment to the idea of originalism as the proper method of constitutional interpretation. And I think that Scalia believed that over time he would be able to persuade his brethren on the court to move in his direction, and particularly given the fact that over the years, 12 of the last 16 justices who've been appointed to the Supreme Court were appointed by Republican presidents and therefore were very conservative. I think Scalia fully expected to be able to turn things around in that way. And I think one of his disappointments would have been that despite his efforts to do that, and despite the fact that he had a stream of potentially sympathetic colleagues, that he could not succeed in that, and that the court itself never did endorse that view. But nonetheless, by injecting that discussion into the discourse, he changed the conversation, changed the arguments about constitutional law, and that was an important part of his legacy. The second is simply that in a range of very important 5-4 decisions, Scalia was one of the 5 justices in the majority, mm-hmm. And that applies to a broad range of issues like gun control in his interpretation of the Second Amendment and campaign finance reform, concluding that it violated the First Amendment, claiming that affirmative action is unconstitutional, and of course Bush versus Gore. So there were a wide range of important decisions in which Scalia, along with 4 other colleagues, was critical to the outcome.
Let's go back to the ideal of originalism, because he did describe himself as an originalist. He believed that the Constitution was a dead document, meaning that it was not open to interpretation. It was not something that grew and was fluid. What was written in that document was the law. He wasn't able, as you said, he wasn't able to convince his colleagues in the current court that was the case. Do you see the court going forward as seeing the Constitution as more fluid? Are some of the decisions that may be coming going to back that up?
I think that, to back up a little bit, I mean, Scalia's, the origins of the modern version of originalism, I think, came from several conservative scholars and judges who very much disagreed with the decisions of the Warren Court and believed that the justices on the Warren Court had taken the liberty of imposing their own personal values on the nation in the guise of a very open-ended and flexible form of constitutional interpretation. And the challenge for them was to figure out, is there another way of doing it? Is there a way of doing it that avoids giving that discretion to judges? And the obvious alternative was the approach of judicial restraint, which basically meant that judges don't hold anything unconstitutional. They basically defer to the elected branches of government, except in extraordinary circumstances. But that was rejected by the originalists because they understood that the framers of the Constitution, in fact, intended for courts to play a more aggressive role than that. And so the question was how to enable the justices and the courts to protect the Constitution while at the same time not inviting the kind of open-ended abuse that they believed the Warren Court was guilty of. And the idea then was basically that the only things that should be held unconstitutional are those things that were essentially understood to be unconstitutional by the original understanding of those who framed the relevant provision. So as an example, Scalia would say that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was clearly designed at the time to deal with the issue of racial discrimination, tells us nothing about discrimination against women or discrimination against gays. And so his view was to basically try to lock the meaning of the Constitution into what he perceived to be the original understanding of those who drafted the Constitution. And the primary critique of that analysis, the reason why it hasn't really carried the day, is twofold. First of all, knowing what the original understanding of the framers was is not very easy.
Right.
And what typically happens is judges who claim to be applying the original understanding are just projecting their own values onto the framers and then assuming that that was the original understanding when there's really no strong historical reason to believe that. And the second problem with it is that it's internally inconsistent, because the truth is those who framed the Constitution didn't themselves believe in originalism. They were men of the Enlightenment, and they believed in evolving knowledge and changing standards of society. And when they wrote open-ended provisions, like Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, or no state shall deny to any person equal protection of the laws, they were not trying to lock in their own conception. They were inviting, in fact, an evolving process of interpretation. So for those reasons, originalism really never carried the day.
And let's go back to what you were saying about his decisions about gay marriage and equal rights, because that's where he came under a lot of fire from people who were more liberal. Was it Was it the fact that he was sticking to his belief in originalism? Did his personal beliefs come in there? And do you think some of the criticism he took was because his opinions were very, very outspoken, some would even say insulting?
Well, I do think that critics argued that Justice Scalia was selective and inconsistent in his claims to be applying an originalist approach. So at the same time that he held, for example, that affirmative action programs were unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause, or that gun regulations violated the Second Amendment, or that corporations had First Amendment rights or religious rights under the Constitution, those were all decisions which people taking originalism seriously could well argue that's not what the framers believed. This is exactly the kind of thing you're critiquing. You're projecting your own values onto the framers, and so that was one of the difficulties. But the other thing that I think is a critique of Justice Scalia is that in doing that, there are many critics who would say that he was in fact imparting his own values into his constitutional interpretation. And so his vehement disapproval of Roe v. Wade or of court decisions that uphold the rights of homosexuals or the right to same-sex marriage were influenced not only by a commitment to an originalist approach to the Constitution, but also by his own personal values that both in the cases that he abhorred, like the ones I just mentioned, and also in the ones that he favored, like gun control being unconstitutional and campaign finance being unconstitutional, also reflecting his own personal values in a way more than he would admit. So I think there were many critics of Scalia's jurisprudence who believed that whatever one thought of the philosophy of originalism, he wasn't actually applying it, interpreting it in a consistent manner. And the reason for that was that he was allowing his own values to intrude. Now, in fairness, I think all justices do that when they are dealing with open-ended provisions of the Constitution and where there are no direct precedents to constrain them. So it's not so much a critique of Scalia that makes him different from other justices. It's just that he was trying so hard to claim that he didn't do that, that it looked sort of hypocritical.
Professor Jeffrey Stone is my guest. He was a friend and colleague of Justice Antonin Scalia. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Professor, if you can hold on just 1 minute, we have a few more minutes with you and a couple more questions. We'll get more with Professor Stone on the other side. It's 720 WGN. Brian Noonan on WGN. We are talking about Justice Antonin Scalia with his friend and colleague, Jeffrey Stone. He is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. And Professor Stone, first of all, my condolences on the loss of your friend. I know you said even though you disagreed greatly on just about everything, you were friends. And I think that seems to be what's missing in a lot of the discourse, not only about Justice Scalia, but about politics in general, that we can have civil disagreements and still remain friends.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that's to the extent that's true, it's a real problem. And it certainly seems to be true in Washington these days. But Justice Scalia, you know, he, two of his closest friends on the Supreme Court were Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Elena Kagan. Ginsburg is someone with whom he enjoyed opera, and Kagan goes hunting with him. And these are two of the more liberal justices on the court. And I know they disagree with Scalia on just about every case. And yet, you know, they are friends, and right. This is the way people should be. And it's to Scalia's credit that in fact, in his personal relations, this is who he was.
Now, it's easy for some to label him just the blanket statement conservative. We know definitely Republican, but some of his decisions would seem to go more toward a middle of the road or liberal leaning. He a lot of decisions about personal privacy, a number of decisions limiting law enforcement, whether they could get DNA during searches, whether they could peep into homes using infrared scopes. So he didn't always make decisions just based on what some people would consider party lines.
No, no justice does that. In fact, Scalia did follow precedents, at least most of the time, and unless he felt a compelling need not to follow a precedent, he would. Also, he had a very specific view of what the original meaning of these provisions was. And in, say, the Fourth Amendment context, I mean, he believed strongly that the Fourth Amendment protected a certain kind of privacy, and if the government invaded that privacy, then it violated the Fourth Amendment. So I think that he was not universally politically conservative in his decisions. There were certainly exceptions, although, again, to be fair, I think it's the case that the vast majority of Justice Scalia's more important decisions would, in fact, fall on the conservative side.
Right. And which decision do you think he will be remembered most for? If there's that, will it be his opposition to certain issues, or will be his championing of certain issues or decisions?
I suspect he'll be remembered mostly for his opposition. I think that partly because in his dissenting opinions, he, particularly later in his career, he was willing, not always wisely, I think, to express his frustration with his colleagues and to write some pretty withering rhetoric about how inept he thought the reasoning and the writing of his colleagues were. And so he really took off, particularly in his dissenting opinions. And that's probably what he will be most remembered for, those opinions, probably what he'll be most remembered for, because, A, he does it so very well, and B, it's so inappropriate.
Well, Professor Stone, I know you have to go. I do appreciate your time tonight. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your insight.
My pleasure. Have a great evening.
Take care. You too. That's Professor Jeffrey Stone. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, colleague and friend of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. We'll do this and be back with more. It's WGN. Hour two of the big show on 720 WGN. I'm Brian Noonan in the Allstate Showcase studio. Karen Conti will be here in an hour. She'll be answering your legal questions, so start formulating them now. 312-981-7200 is how you get a hold of us. That's the phone. That's the text. You can also weigh in on Facebook and Twitter at Brian Noonan Show. Is our definition of female beauty outdated? You think is it finally starting to change? Is enough happening that we're starting to redefine in some people's minds what beauty is? And I know I know there's judgment on male beauty too, but let's be honest, we as a society focus on female beauty a lot. And this time of year, a lot of our focus goes to Sports Illustrated, who for the last 52 years have put out their swimsuit edition, which is, you know, Roger, I'm sure you've seen the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition over the years at some point in your...
Many moons ago, sure.
Sure, sure. Christy Brinkley was on there, mm-hmm. And so many beautiful models. Elle McPherson, so many lovely, lovely ladies.
Very attractive.
Grace the cover. But it was always the same physical type of woman, right?
Right.
A more slender, supermodel-y mm-hmm. kind of woman.
Tall, thin.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they were in... tropical locations, and mm-hmm. they were bending over in certain ways, and there was sand and, you know.
Very seductive poses,
sure.
That most women sitting on a beach don't do.
Yes, exactly. And let's be honest, and we all know fashion is this way. Most women don't look like that. Most women look how they look, and it's fine. But Sports Illustrated has started over... Last year, they started a little. They broke the mold a little. They had a woman who had the audacity, and I say that facetiously. She was a size 12. She was a model. Now, size 12, if you do any research, you know, size 12 for women is about average in this country.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be, if you read all the articles, while there are a lot of women who are under size 12 and oversized 12, 12 seems to be where the average woman falls. So it was a big deal. Not only was it a big deal that they had a size 12 model last year, but it was a big deal that they actually had a what they call plus size model. So a woman who was a size 16, she was in an ad. She wasn't actually in the magazine. She was in an ad for swimsuits. And people heralded that as, hey, that's a little bit of progress, right? Because mm-hmm. now we're allowing women of a certain size to be in a magazine where before you would have poo-pooed it. Now, there was a lot of support for that, which I think there should be, but then there were people who grumbled a little bit. So I'm wondering what those people who grumbled last year are going to do this year, because I don't know if you've heard of Ashley Graham.
No.
She's a model, beautiful young woman. She's size 16. She is a proponent of you know, healthy living and being proud of your body. And she has her own line of clothing, her own line of lingerie. She works with a swimsuit company for I guess, and I'll just use the term because people use it, plus size. You know, people who are women who are not a size 10, you know, size 14 mm-hmm. and up.
The advertising world uses that.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And women understand what that is. Most guys do, too. But some people hear plus size and they think, you know, like morbidly obese, and that's not plus size. Plus no. size is anywhere from basically, I think, like a 14 up. But anyway, Ashley Graham is not only back in Sports Illustrated. She's not in an ad this year. She is one of the models. She's one of the rookies of the year. And yesterday it was announced that Ashley Graham, a size 16 model, is the cover model for this year's Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. And
well,
it is.
Congrats for that.
Congrats. Yeah. And so I'm wondering if this is signaling a changing of the paradigm. If we're starting to say, you know what, you don't have to be a size 4 or a size 0 to be considered attractive anymore. And we're starting to evolve maybe in our acceptance of people. Well, or if this is going to be a fluke and they're going to, you know, Sports Illustrated is going to look at the numbers and they're going to go, well, let's see. Last year's cover with, I don't even know who was on it last year, some swimsuit model. I wonder once you get past like 18, once you're out of college, are you really paying attention to the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue?
Well, here's my contention.
Uh-oh.
We've come a ways, but why for the life of me, I still can't understand, a men's sports magazine has a women's swimsuit issue. Why? There is no reason
because
in the world for
it sells.
I don't care if we go back to your original contention, are we making progress? I'm not talking about sales.
So you're talking about
the whole idea
of Sports Illustrated
is
even
repulsive.
Having a repulsive is strong.
Well,
repulsive
I mean,
is strong.
It is.
That's fine. Okay.
If a man wants to see a female in a swimsuit, first of all, if they are involved in a relationship, they should ask their significant other if, hey, would you put on a swimsuit?
Well, okay. All right, I see where you're going with this. I understand. I think the magazine itself is an innocent distraction for a lot of people. I understand the argument can be made that it does further objectify women.
Exactly.
I think they're trying to nullify that argument by now saying, look, we're inclusive of all women, so it's...
No, there's no nullification whatsoever in that. You are still showing women, scantily clad women, where the chief purpose of the pictures is to show a woman with as little clothing on them as possible to entice men to buy the magazine,
right,
to, as you said, to make sales, to get advertising.
Yeah.
You know, if a woman, if the purpose is to
sell swimsuits. The magazine is targeting at men. They're not trying to sell swimsuits.
Exactly.
They're targeting this at men who want to see beautiful women in bathing suits. And it's a
then
way.
Then go to the beach in the summer.
Please. You're not going to see these women at the, you know, you might see a couple of them over at North Avenue Beach or Oak Street, but this is a whole different thing.
I understand.
This is to get the supermodels. Now, your point, you're welcome to your opinion. I don't think it's that big a deal because I don't pay attention to it. See, I know it's out there.
Same here.
When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. I would get it and I'd be like, oh man. But now listen, if people want to see any sort of image of anyone, if women want to see images of men, if men want to see mm-hmm. images of women, you can find whatever type of image you want within 5 seconds on the internet.
Sure.
So this is kind of a, I guess, an innocent distraction would be how they would describe it. And I got to be honest, women in bathing suits to me is an innocent distraction. These women are not being exploited. These women are being highly paid for their time and their pictures. These aren't pictures that were being taken
right,
from behind
the
a
zoom
bush.
Lens, right.
Right. These are models who have chosen to go into the field of modeling,
mm-hmm.
which, all right, if we're going to carry your contention a step further,
mm-hmm.
well then the entire modeling industry should be done away with because it is nothing but objectifying women.
Right.
But that's not that's never going to happen because every product that is sold needs someone or something to help sell it. And models sell fashion, they sell pop, they sell magazines, they sell everything. So whether you're modeling a sheer evening gown or a bathing suit or lingerie or sporting goods or whatever, that's what sells. So I don't feel that Sports Illustrated is exploitive at all, because these women have chosen the profession. They could easily say, no, I don't want to model swimsuits. I want to model only for Ralph Lauren or, you know, whatever.
Right.
You pick something that shows less skin.
I'm going to give you one more point.
Go right ahead.
And this will get you to think.
I know Elif is waiting to jump in.
I know.
With
the
woman's
here
perspective.
You go. The swimsuit issue did not set the precedent of seeing women in scantily clad clothing.
Seeing women who are scantily clad.
Well, scantily clad.
Right. There's no scantily clad clothing.
Correct. In
I want your argument to be grammatically correct as well as ideologically
correct. And I'm trying
to
form the right sentences here because, and I am a tad older than you.
Yes.
Sears catalog. The women's undergarment section was there for every
because they were
guy.
Selling underwear.
I know.
Then you could. So what do you say? So no publication is supposed to have any image of a woman. National Geographic. Let's go back that far.
Well, the Sears catalog was before National Geographic.
But there's images of women,
right.
And there's images of men in every magazine too.
That's true.
But all right, Elif. I know you've been patiently waiting.
All right.
You've been patiently waiting. Yes, Elif. Hold on. Sorry.
It's okay. I agree with you in that women have chosen that profession for themselves, and that's fine. That's their prerogative. So, but with it being in Sports Illustrated, I was thinking about it for myself, and men and women are very different, obviously, in a lot of ways. But I wouldn't see a good-looking guy on a magazine and be more inclined to buy it.
Right. Well, that's
so.
So you wouldn't buy, if you saw a guy in GQ.
You're not going to buy Men's Health or, yeah. Or,
well, right.
Well, GQ, again, is a magazine. If there was
men's
a
fashion
Cosmopolitan,
magazine.
Cosmopolitan, for
Cosmopolitan
instance.
Or Mademoiselle or Vogue.
Yeah.
If Vogue had a male swimsuit issue, that wouldn't cause you to buy it more than this month than it did last month or next month.
No, because I'm looking for that genre of magazine for my own knowledge, you know, or my own interest.
Well, guys are pigs. We are visual animals. We in the dead of winter, we want to see women in bathing suits. And it's not all guys, of course, but there's enough guys that want to do it that, you know, that's why they do. If people hadn't cared about this issue or seeing swimsuits 52 years ago or 51 years ago, they wouldn't have done the second issue, you know. But yeah, guys do want to see that, and I'm sure there are some women who would if Cosmopolitan or one of the other late women's magazines put out an issue filled with Cosmopolitan used to have male centerfolds back in the day, you know, isn't that where Joe Namath was? Was it in Steve Stone?
The bearskin rug.
Yeah. So
now, real quick, Time Mag. I know you got to go to break. I'm just seeing something on Twitter. It's from Time Magazine.
Sure, Time Magazine.
Right, and here's their headline. Swimsuit issue cover model Ashley Graham, quote, stop labeling women plus size.
Yes, I was going to get to that. She wants, she didn't want them labeled, what I read, didn't want them labeled real women either. She just says women.
Because women, right.
Women are all different size. Well, see, but I understand that point, but let's be, we see some women in these magazines, and because they are a very small percentage of the female population, we think of the majority of women as real women. And while those women are also real women, they're kind of idealized by some for their physical attributes.
Can't we just say guys and gals and put together a musical?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. And then we'll go back to the 40s and we'll, you know, we'll hobnob. 312-981-7200. Couple things on the table. Is the Sports Illustrated issue dated? Is it time for that to go away? And do you look at the new cover model, Ashley Graham, as a step forward in maybe, you know, changing our perception of what is beautiful? 312-981-7200. We've got that and so much more on the other side. It's WGN. Brian Noonan on WGN. We're talking about the new Sports Illustrated swimsuit cover model, Ashley Graham. She is a size 16 model, a woman who has curves, who actually looks like a lot of women that we see running around. She's not one of these stick figure models that we've seen before on the Sports Illustrated cover. Wondering a couple things. One, if you think this is a signal that things, our idea of beauty is changing. And also, as Roger pointed this out, and we'll see if you agree, maybe the time has come that the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue become a thing of the past, that it's, you know, it's not relevant anymore. We don't need it. And that further goes to objectify women and put a outdated vision of beauty in our minds. 312-981-7200. Ryan's been holding on. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Brian. I have enjoyed you since Nick D, so I'm glad to always hear you on Sunday nights.
Well, thank you.
Piece of ear candy for me. But you know what? I guess I'm thinking about the Meghan Trainor song that talks about
all about the bass.
A little more to hold it. Yeah, more about the bass. Men want a little bit more hold it night. My problem is that, you know what, there's such a, it's okay to be what size you are, but nobody's talking about being healthy. Nobody's talking about, I want you to be healthy.
Well, she does. I will say, in Ashley Graham's defense, she is a big proponent about health and exercise and diet, but she also says, listen, everybody's not going to be a size six. You can be, she does push that, but I know what you're saying, Ryan.
And that's my issue. I don't care what's on the cover of Sports Illustrated, whether it's a size 2 or a size 16 or a size 38. It doesn't matter to me. I just want the women healthy, and that includes the two daughters that I have. One is 8, one is 12.
Right.
I want them to be healthy, and I want them to feel good about themselves. I don't care what the rest of the world thinks. I want them to look in the mirror and go, hey, I'm okay with myself. I'm healthy. I'm not diabetic. I'm not overweight. You know, and the doctors are going, okay, keep doing what you're doing. That's what I'm more concerned about.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Ryan. I believe that's what Ashley Graham says, too. She's all about, listen, she had a sold-out TED Talk where she talked about how she used to be ashamed of her body, and then she realized that not everybody was supposed to be the same size and that it was okay. And, you know, she's on Good Morning America all the time talking about exercise and fitness and health, and that, yes, you should be healthy and you should worry about what you're eating, but it's okay to be a different size, but you have to watch out for yourself. And I think maybe that if that's a message that we can take away from the new Sports Illustrated cover, then I'm all for it. Plus, I disagree with Roger. I think it's nice to every once in a while to see. And I'm sure, ladies, be honest. You like seeing the image of a good-looking man, too, don't you, Aleph? Come on. And I know you don't speak for all women. If I'm putting you on the spot, then just decline to answer. But I think everyone likes to see the image of a good-looking person, whether it's, if you like the opposite sex, if you like the same. You just want to see. It's nice to see pretty people sometimes.
Yeah.
Come on. And there's nothing wrong with that. Again, this is not something illicit. This is not something borderline criminal. No one's being enslaved here. It's like, hey, here it is. You want to see beautiful women in swimsuits of all sizes? Here they are. You want to see guys in tight pants with ripped abs? I'm sure when you open up one of the lady, because my mom used to get Vogue all the time, and I've seen my wife and daughter with the Cosmopolitan and those. There's a lot of ads in there with dudes who are ripped.
Yeah, that's
ripped up dudes.
Very true.
Sure, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Thank goodness I'm on radio.
Yeah, me too. Because I'll tell you what, if I had ripped abs, I would be in here with my shirt off nonstop. All I'd do is sit here, and I would wear like compression shorts,
right,
and no shirt, and I would just do the show while doing curls. I'd have like a 40-pound barbell.
A Ron Jeremy kind of look.
No. Ron Jeremy is not ripped at all.
Well, he thought he was.
Wow, you could not have been more off on that analogy. If you had thought to yourself, how could my analogy be the most off base? I'm talking about a guy with ripped abs in compression shorts doing curls, and you bring up Ron Jeremy, one who is a male porn star who is probably the ugliest man on the face of the earth. He's chubby and short and unkempt, and he looks like he would smell. Wow, you were not clear on the concept, were you? Elif, I think he was off. Would you agree? He was way off on that one.
Maybe a little bit. Okay.
See, when Elif turns on you, Roger, you know you were off. Because Elif is one of the kindest people I know. She wouldn't say a bad word. If I was holding her hostage, she wouldn't say a bad word.
No.
And this is true.
She knew you were way off. Wow. How did you get Ron Jeremy from a guy with ripped abs doing curls?
I could not envision you with ripped abs doing curls. I couldn't. Well, it's just the image kind of rambled around in my brain.
Well, you're way off, pal. You haven't seen me without my shirt. All right, let's do this. And then we've got a dad making excuses for a daughter. We've got a Florida story. We've got a naked news story. It's all leading up to Karen Conti after 8 o'clock on WGN. Brian Noonan on 720 WGN. Karen Conti coming up after 8 o'clock. She'll be in here answering your legal questions. So if you have a question, start formulating it now. Get it in early so we can get to it before time runs out. All right, we were talking about Sports Illustrated and the new cover model before we went to the news, and I was positing that both sexes like to look at images of attractive people, and that is not wrong. Susan wants to weigh in. Hi, Susan.
Oh, hi. I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
It's not as simple as it is for men. They just want to look at a thin 18-year-old.
Well, it doesn't have to be thin and 18. I disagree. That Sports Illustrated cover dispels that notion right away. This woman is in her late 20s, early 30s, and she's a size 16. She's beautiful. We like looking at her.
Yeah, but women don't just look at the physical. I mean, to be sure, and I'm 66 years old, I dated one really handsome guy in 1978. He was actually too handsome. And I was 115 pounds. I wore my contact lenses and makeup, and I have blonde hair, yada yada yada. But everybody in it, or aunt and uncle, was after this fella because he was so good looking, and he knew it, and he was after everybody. Apparently, I found out later, having affairs with people at work and yada yada yada. But I think women look, and I'm not to say that I'm not attracted to, like, the old movies. Rock Hudson, there was nobody better looking than Rock Hudson or Cary Grant or some of these older stars. And I can appreciate the guys that I liked. I'm still attracted to a guy that is a couple years younger than me, and he's dying of cancer, and but he's tall and good looking, and he's gay but dying of cancer and lives in another state. But I still, but I think with women it's different. With women, we're looking more for personality. We really look at character and personality and humor. Can they make me laugh? If the guy makes me laugh.
Susan, I understand that for long term, but in the initial attraction for anybody, I believe, is some sort of physical attraction.
The same thing.
Right, exactly. I didn't say everybody liked the same thing. I'm saying whatever it is you like, your physical attraction, what you consider good looking and what Elif would consider good looking could be the same, could be vastly different, but you're going to be attracted to that initially. And then as you get to know somebody, that's when you start learning about their personality and their likes and dislikes and if you're compatible.
My ex-husband was not at all physically attractive, but I was attracted to him because of his intelligence. He had a bachelor's in physics. He was very intelligent. We met at a singles meeting where we talked about topics called the speakeasy. And he was short, But he was smart, and he had a lot of the same opinions as me, and that's what really.
And you weren't physically attracted to him at all?
Well, I mean, not initially, but as we got to know each other, then we became attracted. You know what I'm saying? I just think it's different for women. That's why women can date these men that are so much older and maybe in many cases smarter than they are, and why these older, smarter,
wait, hold
richer
on.
Men.
So wait. So I'm calling you on that one because I got the look from Elif. What do you mean about younger women dating smarter men? So that part I didn't get. So the younger women are dumb and they're trying
women,
to date somebody who's
look
smart?
At all these men, these rich men, they all have a 22-year-old wife, and half of them are from another country. But the only reason these women are dating them, like Donald Trump's wife, and remember when Ivanka was his first wife and he had Moolah Maples? She used to call her Marla Maples, Moolah Maples.
Yeah, but Susan,
Trump's
I think...
he's had a lot of gal pals over the years, and now he's got some foreign gal. They all end up with these foreign 25-year-olds.
Well, Susan, I appreciate the call. We can't say all older guys, thank you. All older guys do this. I've seen a lot of very successful men and a lot of very successful women with age-appropriate spouses who they've been with for a long time. It's not there. Sure, we could all find examples that there are some guys and some women who will leave their spouses at a certain age and go with a newer model, traded it for a newer. I'd never seen you make that face, Elif. I'd never seen you make that like shocked, oh my God, I'm coming through the glass face.
I know it takes.
I liked
a lot.
It
takes a lot to get that out of me.
It was wonderful. So you're, as a young woman, you're not looking for an older, smarter guy.
I mean, he doesn't have to be older or smarter, but, you know, I no.
Yes. Oh, man. And, yeah, Susan, somebody texted and she yada yada. Yeah, Susan had a number of yada yadas. That was, listen, that's fine. Everybody's got their thing. This is an interesting text from the 815. Brian, I'm 62 and have always said, how do blind people fall in love? Listen, I know when I say most people, it's a physical, visual thing. There are always exceptions. But I still, listen, we all were single at one point. Remember back to when you were single, if you've been in a relationship. And even now, there's something, when you see an attractive person, that's what will first draw you to them. That does not mean that they might be a horrible human being. And you might not want to spend any more than 2 minutes talking to them. But there's something intrinsic, something animal, something natural about us. We're looking for the physical. And then you get to know. How many people do you know that they might be good looking, but they're awful inside? And people who other people might not find attractive, you find attractive for any number of reasons. That's just how it goes. That's why there's somebody out there for everybody, because what you find attractive and what I find attractive are completely different. What you find interesting and what I find interesting can be completely different, but there's somebody out there. But most of it is we catch each other's eye first, and then you build on that. Oh, man. All right. I don't want to read these texts without screening them first, because sometimes the text can get away from us. All right, we've got a lot to get to before Karen gets in here. So let's take a quick break. If you want to weigh in, 312-981-7200, you know the number, you know the text. We'll get to some more of that, and we'll get to some more of this. There's a lot to get to. Sure, there is. WGN. Right, do it on 720 WGN. Karen Conti coming up after the news. You have a legal question, get it ready, because Karen's coming in to answer your questions. We'll talk with Karen about Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia as well. So a lot to get to. All right, we've been covering a wide range of topics, from yada, yada, yadas to enjoying looking at pictures or images or seeing attractive people, about Sports Illustrated and its need to be around anymore. A lot of things to get to. Sandy's been hanging on. Hi, Sandy.
Hi there. How are you, Brian?
I'm well, thanks.
Terrific. I just want to say, I think somehow the yada yada lady got you off track. falling in love is not what we're talking about.
Exactly. That's not what I was talking about at all.
We're talking about what I used to have a subscription for my son, Michael, to SI. And okay. You know what? All of a sudden, when they started showing these, you know, the swimsuit issue, I'm like, that's not sports. There's enough magazines out there that with scantily clad women. Why does SI have to do that? I know they want to sell magazines, yada, yada, yada. Okay?
Oh, man, what's with the yada, yada, yadas tonight? When was that episode of Seinfeld on? In the 90s?
Oh, this is,
oh my goodness.
I was making fun of Susan. But anyway.
I love when the listeners make fun of each other. That way I can just step back. So, yeah, no, this argument, and say this argument comes up every year. Why does a sports magazine put out an issue like this? And that, but this issue has this argument has been going on for 52 years, because that's how long they've been doing it. I know, in theory it doesn't make sense, but I will tell you, every guy, I'm sure your son was very disappointed when the subscription stopped. Because
poor baby.
Every
well, then he can go and buy Playboy or
see, but
you know,
this
Hustler
is this. No, oh, well, wait a minute. Let's not equate.
I want him to see sports.
I know, but we cannot equate. We cannot equate Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue with Hustler. They are 180 degrees.
Women in bathing suits equate to sports.
They will tell you it's about fitness. It's about swimming. Swimming is a sport.
Sure.
You ever watch the Olympics, Sandy? A lot of swimmers. Ever see Michael Phelps in his Speedo? Sure you did.
Yeah.
I know you did. Don't lie to me. Don't lie to me.
Well, you can't help it if you're watching it.
Sure.
That's what he's wearing.
Well, so they're going to say it's about celebrating the athletic human form.
That's what he's wearing.
I know. Well, that's what these women are wearing. That's what they wear to the beach. When you're in Tahiti, you go to the beach in a bikini. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they do it. Sandy, I appreciate your call. And tell your.
And I do agree with you when you said all men are pigs. Absolutely.
Well, see, at least I got somebody agreeing with me on something. Thanks,
there you
Sandy.
Go.
Have a good night. Look at that. And now I'm going to get the men calling up. We're not all pigs. Come on, fellas. Of course not. Fred's been hanging on. Hi, Fred.
Yes, hi, Brian. I just want to add that I'm totally blind now. When I had 20/20 vision, everything was about what girls looked like.
Right.
When I lost my vision, it became obvious to me that that's the least important thing you should be noticing. It's personality. It's likability. It's what's inside of them that's important.
Yes, of course. Of course, Fred. That's every.
I mean, when
everybody knows that.
How does a blind person fall in love? It has nothing to do. You know.
Sure, and that's why I said there's always exceptions. But when you said you had 20/20, you had your vision prior, right?
Yep.
And then my point was not about falling in love, not about having long relationships. My point was initial attraction is usually based on physical appearance. We see something that we find appealing, whether it's a woman, whether it's a car, whether it's a sandwich. We're attracted to things we find appealing. Then it gets into personality. Then it gets into all of the other things that build a relationship. But that is not what I was talking about. I was talking about the instant animal attraction usually is based on sight and physical appearance.
Well, there is a little bit of that in voices for me.
Okay.
Some moment is...
Wow.
That's not going to, you know what I mean?
You and Brenda Vaccaro never going to hit it off. Is that what you're telling me, Frank?
Well, Fred? I'm just saying yes, probably. Okay.
Sure. Oh, no. But so there's something, so even visually impaired, there's something appealing that is the initial draw for you. It's someone's voice. If a woman has an appealing voice, you'll take some time to get to know her better. If she's, as you described, phlegmy and gravelly and like she smokes 8 packs a day, you're going to pass.
Or even a perfume.
See? So there's always something, right? Always something that drags us in. Fred, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much. All right. Well, boy, we didn't get to most of what we were going to get to, but I have to do what I think was the funniest story of the week. I have to. And it's only listen, before, and again, I don't know why, people, it's Valentine's Day. People are sensitive tonight. You think it's because of all the focus on love today? So everybody's very on edge, very sensitive to all kinds of things. So, yes, if you were the person on the receiving end of this, not funny. If you were the Gator, probably not funny. Taxi driver Bob is texting in, oink, oink, oink. He's proud of it, proud of being a pig as a man. Man accused of tossing a gator at the drive-thru. Yes, it's a little Florida news, as you can only imagine. Did you hear this story, Roger?
Yeah, sure
yeah,
did.
It's a good story. Alligators have been used as shoes, briefcases, university mascots, all of the above. But Joshua James was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon. I don't know, I guess a gator could be a deadly weapon.
Of course.
Throw it mouth first. Depends how big the gator is. A little baby gator is not going to kill you.
It was a fairly
pretty good size gator.
Yeah,
drove his pickup truck to the drive-through. I skipped a paragraph. Oh, he went to Wendy's. That's it. Went to a Palm Beach County Wendy's. Threw a 3.5-foot alligator through the drive-through window. He did that back in October. He's also boy. They move slow down there, don't they?
Yeah. Well, gators do unless you know.
We'll catch him.
Yeah.
Not the gator moving slow. Law enforcement moving slow. He was just arrested this week, and he did this in October. Well, you know, he's not going anywhere. That kid'll come back. He'll be fine.
It's Florida.
It is Florida. It's the heat and the humidity and the bugs and the gators. He's also charged with illegally possessing an alligator and petty theft. Records show that he was released on a $6,000 bond. Wildlife officer Nicholas Guerin said in his report that James drove his pickup truck to the window at about 1:20 a.m. Once you go into any sort of fast food drive-thru at 1:20 a.m., chances are you have been probably imbibing. I think there would be. Chances
slightly.
Are. Doesn't mean everybody.
No.
Goodness. Don't you get sensitive
all
too.
Over you.
Don't get you get sensitive too, Roger. Obviously, everybody.
No, I
everybody
agree
who's
with
at a
you.
Yes. And so, after an. And it's. All right. I don't care if you disagree. If people disagree. If you're at a Wendy's drive thru at 1:20 in the morning with an alligator in your truck, you've been drinking or you're high. There's no, I don't care. You didn't just come from church. You didn't just come from your job. You're not on your way to work the graveyard shift and had to drop your gator off somewhere. Mm. You're hammered.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. There. Wow. After an employee had, ooh, wow. It's all
deep
about
breath.
Love on
deep
Valentine's
breath.
Day. After an employee handed James's drink, he threw the alligator through the window and drove off.
Keep
I
the
said
change,
Coke
you
Zero. Wow. This is not a large soda. Whoop, have my gator. Just holding it. Imagine driving up.
Yes, I'd like the number one with a Coke.
And he's just waiting, biding his time. He's got the gator by the scruff of the neck. Do gators even
pickles.
Have necks? He's holding it by the mouth, by the snout, and then he just whips it in there. And how do you throw a gator? Like a football? Do you chuck it two-handed?
Well, you want
do
to
you
make
swing
sure
it
that
over
it
your
goes...
head by the tail like a slingshot? And then just, yeah, you got to make
You've
it.
You've got to have both hands.
It's got to clear your window. It's got to clear the counter because most times you're lower than the drive-through window, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to. It's got to be thrown at an upward angle. It's got to clear your car. It's got to clear the lip of the window, and then it's got to get through the half window that they open at the drive-through because they don't open. It's not a big thing. They just want to hand your food
out. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. He threw it in. No one was hurt, thank goodness. He captured the alligator and released it into the wild. This was the wildlife officer captured it. He said James was tracked down through video surveillance and a purchase at a neighboring convenience store. What did he throw at the convenience store?
Well, he was out of gators. We knew
maybe
that.
Maybe he had a manatee. Just a bit. He's got that's in the back of the pickup truck. Hey, come on out here for a second. I can't throw this manatee. It is way too heavy. I'm going to put a handle on it. Just you got any hangers? You got a stick? Something I could jam into that manatee and carry it around like a caramel apple?
A flatbed.
Guerin wrote that James admitted throwing the alligator. He said he told him he had found the gator on the side of the road and put it in his truck. Sure he did. His mom said it was just a stupid prank. He does stuff like this because he thinks it's funny. She said, "That was my mom's excuse for me 99% of the time. He just thinks he's funny."
Yeah.
I never threw a gator though. I'll break, Elif. Hang on. I'm almost done. She said he meant no harm and that no problem turning himself in. No, of course not. A retired scientist said a 3.5-foot alligator would likely weigh about 20 to 30 pounds, and its hard body could deliver quite a jolt if it struck someone. It doesn't have to strike you to deliver a jolt.
It just has to sneak its head through a little window.
Imagine a gator flying at you.
Yeah.
You'd be terrified. All right, listen. I have terrified Elif with my total disregard for time. Hey, It's Sunday night. You know what that means. Karen Conti comes in and joins me to help you answer your legal questions. 312-981-7200. That's the phone. That's the text. People already lining up. They have listened tonight. Get your calls and texts in early so that we have plenty of time to answer them. Happy Valentine's Day. You
all
adorned in red.
I got my red going on.
You do. You look very festive, very excited. Did you have a nice romantic Valentine's Day with Jerry?
It was okay. It was a kind of day to just hang out inside and do not a whole lot. But,
yes.
But I did get you a little gift because I figured that you might want to take this home and share it with your wife.
Wow.
Well, or just drink it. Just drink it yourself on the way home.
Listen, after
and
the
then
way,
call me.
After the way tonight's been going, I'm. Thank you very much. That's so nice of you. Look at that. A little chocolate on top.
Yeah. That was my idea.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jerry. That's very wow. You're very thoughtful. Very lovely.
Yeah.
That's very nice. Now, before we get to the calls, because calls are already coming in.
Yes.
I was waiting all day because I wanted to get your thoughts on Antonin Scalia and his passing, what that means. Now, you actually have had some, you've had contact with him.
I shared
a cocktail with him.
I did, at a cocktail party at University of Illinois. You know, I completely disagree with his politics, his legal decisions. I actually argued before the Supreme Court when he was there and had a little, my late husband had a little talk with him about some things. It was interesting, which he remembered years later,
was
very interesting because it was a very funny incident. But he is very charming. He is wildly smart. And you know, but he's cocky. You know, he was so sure of himself about everything, and you know, I could see why people really were attracted to him because of his brilliance. But he was very opinionated, and I think maybe just a little arrogant.
Yeah.
I would say. But he
certainly
left his mark.
You could draw that from some of his opinions, couldn't you?
I mean, you know, you see, when we read opinions a lot as lawyers. Yeah. That's what we do because that's what the law, I mean, the law is written, but the law, how the law is interpreted is case law, and we read a lot of it. And you can read a lot into a case by reading how a judge phrases things. And Scalia was always scathing. When he didn't agree with someone, it wasn't just enough for him to say, I respectfully disagree, and this is why. He was a brilliant writer, by the way. But he would sometimes get personal with the other justices, in my view, and would be scathing and almost to the point where how could anyone think anything differently because they're stupid and I'm smart. Of course, he didn't say those exact words, but that was the import of it. And I just don't think that's necessary. And frankly, if he wanted some consensus building on that court, he never got it for that reason. He was very polarizing, and he would be way on the other side on the dissents with maybe Clarence Thomas, and then the other people were on the other side. But there might have been some issues where he could have brought some people to the middle, but he could just never do that.
It was his way, and that was it. And
yes,
He believed whether it was originism or you know, that was his thing, but then he didn't always follow those decisions.
And,
right,
you know, his idea was that the Constitution was written in stone, and anything that the Constitution says should not be a document that lives and breathes. If it says a vehicle cannot you know, go into this area, that means a vehicle cannot go into this area. And the example that the scholars give is, well, what about an ambulance? Of course an ambulance can go into that area.
Right.
But he would say no, because if it says vehicle, you look at the plain meaning, and that's that. And if there were no ambulances back when the Constitution was written, well, then there are no ambulances allowed, which leads to really illogical conclusions, in my view.
Right, and that's been an argument that I talked to someone about that earlier, and I've heard people discuss that all the fact that you can't just know what the framers of the Constitution meant, because we don't know exactly what they meant. So not put things in because there was going to be interpretation down the road or not?
Well, and we're living in such a different world. I mean, some of the things, if you think about, would have not even crossed the minds of those people.
Exactly.
But frankly, our Constitution has lived and survived really well, I think, for the most part. And so, you know, disagree with him. But I think as any person on that court, they come with an ideology. They do. And the idea that Obama's going to appoint some liberals. Well, guess what? Probably he will. He'll probably, you know, get some people who come from a minority background. He says people come to the court with life experiences. It makes a difference in how they view these things. It's not a cold, hard decision most of the time. And it's the same thing with Scalia. He brought his conservatism to all of his opinions, I believe.
And is there any judge at any level that can completely divorce themselves, do you think, from their own... You don't want to make rulings solely on your personal beliefs, but can anybody divorce themselves completely from their personal beliefs?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I mean, you are bound to follow other case precedent, but when you're up at the Supreme Court, you know, you're the ultimate arbiter of the law. So you're basically a branch of government, and that's why it's so interesting to argue there, because you're really not arguing a case for your client at this level. You are arguing to change the law or change the interpretation of the law that has been, has come down from another branch of government. It's a very high-end intellectual endeavor. And listen, you know, whether it's on gay rights, whether it's on abortion, whether it's on immigration, certainly your own personal experiences will come to the table about what is right and what is wrong. And you see that. And you see Scalia was really awful when it came to gay rights. I mean, he all across the board. And I'm sure that comes from his very conservative Catholic upbringing. And he has nine kids and he didn't believe in birth control. And so you read his opinions and you get that.
Right. And even though that some of his early decisions on that may have pushed the ultimate decisions through, which, you know, he must have been angry about that. But but we'll never know. All right. When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit before we get to some calls and texts. There's a number of big cases coming up in front of the Supreme Court in the next few months. And right now there's a lot of talk about, you know, there might not be a new justice in there, which would leave only eight. And the way things have been going, most of the decisions have been 5-4. So now we're going to talk a little
bit
about what's going to
happen.
Exactly. So we'll get into all of that and get your calls. Karen Conti's here. She's answering your legal questions. 312-981-7200. How do people get a hold of you during the week if they don't get through today?
You can call me at 312-332-7800. Or better yet, email and leave me all your facts. Tell me what your facts are. KConti, KConti, at kcontilaw.com.
More with Karen on the other side. It's WGN. Employed by Chicago Public Schools, reprimanded by the school board. Why one local principal is risking his job to speak out. It's Monday's cover story on WGN TV News at 9. Oh my goodness, it's almost time for another Hometown Voices. Stop on the Hometown Voices tour, rather. This one is with the boys from The Beat, and it's happening Saturday the 20th. Skokie is the next stop on the WGN Radio Hometown Voices tour, presented by Allstate. This is exciting. We've partnered with the Chicago Blackhawks for a special broadcast of The Beat from 3 to 7 p.m. from the Blackhawks store at the Old Orchard Mall on Saturday, February 20th. Bring your family to celebrate Hockey Weekend across America. The first 100 kids are invited for a free skate on the mall's ice rink presented by the Chicago Blackhawks. To learn skating tips from the Blackhawks ice crew and Blackhawks youth hockey team, Visit the store and enter for a chance to win prizes, too. Visit the events page at WGNradio.com for all the details. The WGN Radio Hometown Voices Tour is presented by Allstate, Chicago's own Good Hands. So that'll be Saturday. Get out to Old Orchard, see the boys from The Beat do their show, and get your kids out there and do a little ice skating. Karen Conti's here. She is helping you with your legal problems. 312-981-7200. That's the phone and the text. Before we get to those, let's wrap up our discussion about Scalia. And we were talking about how there's a lot of big cases coming in front of the court within the next few months. Now it looks like it's going to be 4-4 ties. What do you anticipate happening? Because, let me ask you this first. Once something is scheduled to be heard in front of the Supreme Court, can they delay it? Is it like other courts where you a continuance? Like, we're not going to hear anything until we figure it out? Or are they going to go ahead with...
They won't. It'll be business as usual for them. They completely avoid all politics and those kinds of things. As to the cases that have already been heard, the justices will vote without him. And in the event of a tie, the lower court opinion remains the same. So there's no change. So if the case came up and found someone guilty of a crime, and there's a tie, 4-4, then that person remains guilty, and there is no decision.
Okay.
Basically, as if there were no decision, okay?
Right.
Business as usual. And it's interesting because everyone's saying that the Republicans are going to block the appointment, but
Republicans are saying that.
Well, they're going to do that with at risk because they've got immigration, they've got abortion, they've got voting rights cases, they've got a lot of very important cases coming down the chute right now. So if they wait for a full year before before they allow a confirmation, which would be unprecedented.
Right.
And frankly, you know, as much as I, you know, can understand why they would do it politically, they don't want someone liberal in for the next 30 years. It really puts the whole branch of government in a bad situation. And I can't imagine that people aren't going to say, you know what, you guys, politics is bad. You know, we don't like all this, but you're now affecting a branch of government's ability to do their job.
Right.
And there's something seriously wrong with that. So, you know, are they going to wait or are they going to push it through? I don't know. And Obama's, you know, we're all speculating about who he might appoint.
Right.
And it's going to be an interesting year from
it
the standpoint
is.
Of the court.
And 13 months, because the president is still president till January 20th. So that's a long time to go without a justice. There is also talk that, you know, will it change the outlook of the Senate? Because there's so many Senate seats up for grabs in swing states. And if they push it and it looks like they're obstructing government, will that cost them seats? So there's a lot of things in play. And all of a sudden, it's a big deal for voters, too, who may not really pay that much attention to the Supreme Court on a regular basis.
I think that's the problem. I think people don't see that the Supreme Court is a very powerful branch of government. I mean, it's equally as important as executive and legislative, and that if it's not functioning properly, that's a problem. And,
right.
you know, and it could seriously impact everybody's rights, whether it's Obamacare, whether it's immigration, whether, you know, these are very important decisions.
Right. It's going to, and you make a great point, because it will affect everyone's rights, not one side or another, because as you said, if something's made it to the Supreme Court and it's a tie, well, that ruling stands. So if you were hoping to get something changed when it got to the Supreme Court, it's going to be tough.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I've been reading a lot of the different tacks the president could take, and you know, I also heard the argument, and you know the law, that the president, It's within his constitutional right. He's supposed to appoint someone now, even though his term didn't end after 3 years. He's got 4 years of his term.
Oh, he does.
So whoever the president was, they should make the appointment.
And this process takes a long time. I think the average time that it takes is about 75 days. But, you know, could they delay it? They could absolutely delay it. I'm really going to be interested to see how the public reacts to that, because I think the public is sick and tired of the back and forth. I think they're watching this debate with the Trump and the nastiness and the name calling. It has gotten to the worst point I've ever seen it. Probably
South Carolina was a little crazy last
night. And so now we're going to have, you know, basically, you know, them standing there saying we're not going to allow a branch of government to do their job. I think people should get mad about that.
And we'll see if they do. Let's get one call in before the news.
Let's do
Pete's been hanging on the longest. He's in Rosemont. Hi, Pete. You're on WGN.
Oh, hi. I'm a creditor in a bankruptcy case. And, we just recently learned that the person who filed for bankruptcy committed some financial crimes. They forged a bunch of checks from a company that is not on the creditor list. We reported this stuff to the company right away. About a month later, this person reported herself to the company and worked out a restitution plan. And what we would like to know is, this company is not on the list of creditors, and how could
I see what you're saying, Pete. What you're saying is that why did she get to pay them back first, as opposed to the creditors who are standing in line waiting for their money? And, you know, I don't know the exact answer, because I'd have to probably review the paperwork, but just know that in a bankruptcy, an intentional act and a crime is never dischargeable in bankruptcy, whereas other money is. So, like, if someone owes money to a credit card, that's dischargeable in bankruptcy, meaning it could go away. But if I owe parking tickets, or if I embezzle money, or I have an order that I'm going to, you know, have to pay someone back, that gets paid despite the bankruptcy.
Right.
Why? Because the courts and the law says we're not going to give people who commit crimes the benefit of the bankruptcy laws. Okay. So she would have had to have paid that back anyway. So I think what we're going to find out here is, even if they weren't a creditor, technically, they would have been paid back anyway. So you probably don't have a good argument that they came before you.
All right. Sorry about that.
I have just one more question real quick.
Sure, real quick.
Okay. What is the statute of limitations on a felony forgery count for over $10,000?
I don't know. I would have to go look up the law. Yeah. And it, you know what? And it could be that she's voluntarily paying that back. And, you know, it may not matter what the statute of limitations is. It may be that she was caught doing it. They cut a deal. And I don't think the court's going to undo that deal. I think she's going to pay that money back. And I don't think you have much of an argument one way or the other.
All right. Sorry about that, Pete. Good luck. We'll get to more of your calls because Karen Conti is answering your legal questions. 312-981-7200. Get your calls and your texts in. We'll get to those on the other side of the news on WGN. Sunday night means Karen Conti joins me, and she answers your legal questions. 312-981-7200. Get them in. All right. We had a text question that came in early. This person avoided the rush, Karen, and texted at about 7 o'clock. So I want to get to that one, and then we'll get to the phones. If you recall, and it's funny, as we read this, I read this to Karen, we both do recall the initial contact with this texter from the 708. I was rear-ended by a police car and charged with recklessness. I went to court and proved my case via my dash cam. The charges were dropped after the prosecutor and policeman turned white after viewing the footage. I then asked the judge to direct the prosecutor to charge the officer with perjury and malice for charging me. The judge declined, saying the charges were dropped. I said, that may be, but this would be a new charge, and I'm a complaining witness for a crime that just occurred, that being perjury, and that my being charged is obvious evidence of malice. The prosecutor was stupefied. The judge said, take it up with the state. What should I do?
Well, you can't make the prosecutors prosecute, and the judge can't do it either. So you have to get the prosecutors to prosecute. And are you really going to get the prosecutors to prosecute a cop? Probably not. They don't do it very often, and certainly not in a case like this. They probably want this to go away. So good luck with that. I'd say, you know, I know you're angry. I know you were angry when it happened. A rear-ending by a cop, you know, usually, I mean, someone who rear-ends you is the
sure,
culpable
the
one. They should have seen you and stopped in time. So you would have no legal liability in that, and I don't know why you were charged if you're telling me all the facts. So, you know, again, a lot of people are angry about the way things go, and there's really sometimes just nothing to do from a legal or practical standpoint.
Right.
So just take this and know, and you can make your reports if you want to report him to the Department of Professional, I forget the name of the organization for police officers. But, you know, you're going to have to probably prove that it's perjury. And is there a transcript? And will you, you know.
And how do you prove malice? Or can you prove malice?
I mean, perjury, it really don't need malice for perjury. Perjury is really just a false statement of fact of a material nature. So if someone said I'm 43 and I'm really 42, that's not material. But if it's, you know, something very material to the case and it's a fact and the cop said the wrong thing and it's provably false, that could be perjury. Yeah, it's real serious. It should be real serious, but I don't have any confidence this is going to be prosecuted. I think this is something you're just going to have to walk away from.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phones. John's been hanging on for a while. Hi, John.
Hey, Karen and Brian, how are you?
Hi, John.
Good. What's your question,
Karen,
John?
Karen, I have a quick question. If there's a marriage that ends after 20 years and there's a teacher's pension involved, are there any circumstances where that pension for the period of time would not be split 50-50?
So it was earned during the marriage, correct?
Correct.
It's almost always split 50-50 unless you do something else. So, for instance, if there's an asset somewhere, let's just say that your pension is valued at $200,000, and it's kind of difficult to value a pension. You have to get people, actuaries, to do that. Let's say it's valued at $200,000. And let's say there's a house that's worth, you know, $200,000. Maybe you give her the $200,000 house and you keep your pension. Let's just say you can do it. So you can set off, is what I'm saying. You can set off your pension with another asset that's similarly valued. The other argument that you could probably make is that you don't get Social Security, correct?
Because
you're a teacher, you just get your pension. So maybe there's some argument that you could make to say she's going to be able to get Social Security, I'm not. I should get at least, you know, more of that pension than she should. So all these arguments can be made to, you know, to the judge.
Yeah, everything would be split 50-50 as far as all assets in the home. But what about the start of the pension?
What do you mean the start?
As far as giving the half of the 50%
to my ex.
Well, would they enter a quadro or a quildro, which means it's a qualified domestic relations order, which sits on the pension until you get it. When you get that pension, then you will get a certain amount and she will get a certain amount. So that's what gets entered. And so when that does not obviously take effect unless and until you get that pension. So that's an order that gets entered, sent to the pension organization, whatever that organization is, and it's set in stone as of the date of your divorce.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Have a great night.
All right, you too. Good luck.
Take care. We've been Bill's in Chicago. He's been waiting. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hello, Karen.
Hi, Bill.
I knew if I listened to you long enough that eventually I'd have a very important question to ask you, and it finally has come now. It has to do with my dad and I. We had joint ownership of 460 shares of stock in the company that he worked for.
Okay.
And it was a deal where I could not touch them as long as he was alive. I would have to get his permission, you know, to cash them in. And
okay.
Now that he passed away, I want to know, is there a lot of red tape to go through to cash those in now?
You know,
the sole survivor.
Yeah, you know, this would probably be a better question for a financial advisor. I'd have to know, you know, how, you know, are you power of attorney? Are you the trustee of the estate? Can you sign his name? I don't know what kind of company this is. Is it a small company? Is it a large company? What is the process?
Can I tell you the name of the company? Or?
It's you know, it doesn't matter, and probably best not to do that. But
it's a big, huge company, famous American company. So.
Okay. Well, then there's probably a procedure that they have for selling stock. You would call up the company and you'd find out what that procedure is. And I'm sure you're not the only person that's inherited stock. And they would have a method for you to do that.
We've owned these stocks for over 25 years. And about two years ago, I get a letter from the state. They're threatening to take possession of those stock because there was no activity on that account for years and years. And I thought, well, isn't that the reason to hold on to stocks? Once you get them, you just let them grow and grow. You don't touch them if you don't want to. They're threatening to take them away, take possession of them. So.
Okay, well,
that doesn't sound right.
But no, but I would say, you know, you can try to do it yourself, or you can get your CPA or accountant to do it.
All right, good luck, Bill. Hope it works out for you. Let's go to one more. Karen Conti's here answering your legal questions. 312-981-7200. Teresa's in Barrington. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Oh, this is so exciting.
it's exciting for me, too, Teresa. So.
Oh, good. Okay. So my question is, my son's high school is not allowing him to have a copy of his math test. So I think this is considered an educational record, and he and his parents are entitled to a copy. I found a few, I found FERPA, Family Educational Rights and Privacy, and I found Illinois Student Records Act that states that we should be entitled to a copy. So
why are they not giving you a copy of the test, and why is it so important for you to have it?
Well, they're not giving a copy. They say because they spend a lot of time and the quality of the tests are so great that basically they don't want kids cheating. They don't want kids making copies and giving them out.
Okay. And I remember in school that would happen quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, that because they're going to give it next year and they don't want kids to know what's on it.
Right.
So
sure.
And so what is your driving force to get that test?
Because when it comes to finals, we like to take a look at the test with my son and see if there's any pattern of error, anything we can do to help him improve.
Okay.
Do they not give out, legal things aside, don't they give out study guides when it comes time for finals at the high school?
They do. Yep, they do. But that doesn't help if he makes a common error, he often will do a negative sign or he'll do something common.
And I'm sure
find a pattern.
I'm sure you've thought of this, but wouldn't the teacher sit down with him in after school at some point and go over the test with him to show him what he made mistakes on and so that would give him that feedback that you want for him, but it wouldn't have the test go out to the public so that it could be used. Would that solve the problem?
No. I mean, in an ideal world, that would happen, but usually the teacher has to rush home or. He starts school at 7:20 in the morning, and they want him to come at 6:30 in the morning, and that's difficult.
Well, I don't I'd have to look at the law to see if this falls under that act. My guess would be that it doesn't, but that's just a guess. My guess would be that that act applies to records such as, you know, disciplinary issues and things like that that go into a kid's file for purposes of, you know, following them to college. But like an individual test, to me, wouldn't be the type that would fall under that act. But again, I would have to read it. I'd have to analyze it. And there are lawyers who do this. I just don't know how far you want to take it.
Okay.
All right,
you know, there's lawyers who do all this educational stuff, and they can certainly give you an opinion on it. But, I'm not sure how – it just seems like a lot of energy for something that may or may not. I mean, Teresa has a reason.
Thanks, Teresa. Appreciate the call. Good luck with that. All right, Karen Conti's here. How can people get a hold of you during the week if they don't get through tonight?
You can call me at 312-332-7800 or email me with the facts. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what it is you need and what you want, and I'll hopefully get back to you. kconti@kcontilaw.com.
All right, more with Karen on the other side. It's WGN. Karen Conti is here, and she is answering your legal questions. 312-981-7200. That's the phone. That's the text. Let's go to the text line, shall we?
Let's do it.
Here's one. My son's away at college and renting a house on campus with 9 other boys. Man, that's a lot of dudes in a house.
Boy, that I don't even want to go there.
The smell, I can only imagine. But that's not the issue. The house burned in January so severely that they're unable to occupy the house. Now they're living in a new rental. Are we still entitled to our security deposit back from the first rental? That's a good question.
Yeah, it makes sense that you would. Yeah, absolutely. The lease term was ended. I assume it wasn't their fault and they're not being sued for starting the fire. So the lease term is ended and that security deposit was to secure that last payment. There is no last payment, so they should get that security deposit back.
Yeah, even if the lease ran through May, you know, because it was supposed to be the whole school year, but they can't live in the place anymore, right?
Right. I don't see why not.
Okay. Yeah, like you said, as long as they didn't start the fire,
yep.
Right? People like me who are prescribed methadone, this is from a texter, not me personally.
Okay.
815. People like me who are prescribed methadone for pain now have to do an office visit every month. It's DEA mandated. Who should we complain to?
I'm not quite sure what the complaint. The complaint is it's a pain in the butt to do this, that you shouldn't have to do that. Well, you know, I do know that the Department of Justice, which is the organization that where the DEA falls under, has really come down hard on some of these clinics that give out pills. They call them pill mills and all this. And there's a lot of abuse in this area.
Sure.
So I understand that they're making laws and rules that are much more strict than they have been in the past. You know what? You can complain all you want, and I'm sure the Department of Justice has a website, and there are places where you can comment about the various laws and bills and how they're being enforced. But I just don't know how far that's going to go. I mean, if they've made the rule to undo it, I don't know what your complaint is going to do. But, you know, I would say go out to the Department of Justice website and see if there's a place for comments.
Right, and send it there.
Yep.
All right, well, good luck. Let's go back to the Supreme Court for a little bit.
Okay.
What's the justification or the thought process behind lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court? Because that's kind of why, like right now, we're going to be in all this political turmoil because people are concerned about lifetime appointments. Was this always the case with the Supreme Court, and why do they think that that's a good idea
It's always been the case, and the idea behind it is that we don't want to politicize that branch of government. We have elected branches of government, the executive branch and the legislative branch, and that's governed by the people's will and the people's choice. But I think the founders, you know, decided that, you know, we don't want the analysis of the law to be driven by people's, opinions and political opinions. So instead, we're going to have these justices, they're supposed to get rid of all the ideas that if they rule one way, they can't get voted out of office. I mean, you know, we see that a lot in state court. So, like, for instance, I don't know if you remember, we've had some high-profile cases where judges have let people off of certain crimes and everyone's up in arms about it.
Yes.
And then everyone vote against this guy for retention. And, you know, and these are good judges who just so happen to follow the law. You know, and was the result bad?
Right.
Yeah, we all agree the result was bad, but he was following the law as he was sworn to do. So I get why you like to have judges in long-term positions, because you don't want the will of the people to say, because a lot of people, you know, and I'm not saying that lawyers are smarter or judges are smarter, but a lot of people don't understand how judges are bound to follow case precedent. And you don't want it to be subject to a person's whim. I mean,
Would this be a feasible alternative where you got a term of, I don't know, 15 years, and then you don't know who's going to be the president in 15 years, and then your term is up, and that president, whoever's serving, appoints, and then, you know, because it would
be
staggered, whoever, you know, everybody didn't come on to the court at the same time, so everybody wouldn't be rotated off at the same time.
You know, that could very well be. But there's a lot of judges, like the federal judges that sit in the federal courts and the appellate federal courts. I mean, they're appointed basically for life, subject to impeachment.
Right.
So it's not an unusual thing. And I understand what you're saying, but I don't know. I don't have a problem with it, having a lifetime appointment.
And then
you just
kind of roll the dice whenever a justice is going to retire or, in Scalia's case, die. Then you just, whoever happens to be in office,
that's
the way it goes.
There's going to be a randomness to it anyway, because people are going to die in office. People going to be staggered in different times. So,
well, you look at President Obama. Now, this would be his third appointment.
Yeah.
You know, in 8 years, whereas you went before, it was a long time since the last one.
Absolutely. And so, you know, it's going to be an interesting year is all I have to say. There's going to be all kinds of machinations. And we talked about this off air. I just don't know that people care so much about the Supreme Court because they don't think it impacts them.
Right.
So to the extent that Republicans are going to block, I think a lot of people are going to say, good, we don't need another Supreme Court justice. I don't think that's a bad idea. Let's wait until Trump gets elected. Let him, what he's talking about, appointing his sister. Did you hear this?
Yeah. Well, no, today he came out and said,
he was just kidding.
I was just kidding.
I don't know if he's kidding about anything.
Huge. Having my sister on the Supreme Court would be huge.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he's a bundle of fun.
He is.
Here's a question. How is the easiest way for me to find a marriage certificate? I'm involved in a legal situation with my ex-husband, and he is vehemently denying that he is married. But I have seen wedding reception pictures and things like that. If you could give me some information or some advice, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, you get a marriage certificate from, if she's in Cook County, can we tell where her area code is?
847.
847. So I don't know if it's Lake, maybe it's Lake County.
But we don't know if the husband was married.
So for instance, Cook County, you get your marriage certificate at the Department of, Office of Records. So like death and birth certificates and all that. You go down there and you get your certificate. So there should be some record of that in the county where he resides or where he got married. So,
Are those covered under freedom of information?
You know,
are those open records?
I believe they are open records, and I'm just blanking right now on how to go about getting them. If you can actually go down and request them and pay a little bit of money for them, and it probably takes a while to get them, but they might even be on a computer record at some point.
Okay.
So, but you know what, if that person would like to email me, I can get the exact information, and if she can tell me perhaps what county he got married in, I can maybe even give you some more specific information.
What's that email address?
You can email me at kconti@kcontilaw.com.
All right, now our time is up for here, but tomorrow morning, if people want to see your lovely visage early, you'll be on TV, right?
I will be on Fox talking about Scalia, and I'm going to be on about 7 o'clock in the morning.
Wow, that's nice and early.
It's
no
nice
pajamas for TV.
No pajamas for TV. I got to put on my dancing shoes.
But Wednesday morning with Steve Cochran, you can be in your pajamas at 6:40.
That's right, and I usually am, and so is he.
Very nice. Yeah, I've seen him do his show, the pajamas. It's the one piece with the flyaway bottom. I'm not a fan, but that's a personal fashion choice on my part. Have a great week.
Okay.
We will talk to you. Oh, we won't talk to you next Sunday, correct?
You know what? I might be coming back on an earlier flight. So
this is I'm going to be.
It's
I
up
don't
in the
want
air.
To know one way or another.
It's
at
up
8
in the
o'clock,
air.
I'll see. Hopefully you're here.
Hopefully I'll be here.
If not, I will answer your legal questions.
Uh-oh,
and
I better
next,
get my
then
butt
the
back
next
here.
Week, Karen will get you out of that jam. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day. Let's do this, and then we'll come back and say goodbye. It's WGN. Thank you for listening. Thanks for being part of the program. I will talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3 when I sit in for Rokan. Thanks, Ella, for your hard work tonight. Thank you, Roger, for the exhaustive road conditions and everything else you do for the program. After Hours with Rick Kogan comes your way on the other side of the news.